911, what's your emergency?
Help! My roommate's fucking my neighbor.
What's the emergency?
He should be fucking me instead!
That was a good Buck impression. Are you happy with it?
I'm pretty happy with it. I was halfway between like gruff Oliver Stark voice and like, you know, one of those like shonen anime English four kids dub protagonists, which honestly,
well,
I feel like Buck
kind
spiritually
of how he talks.
Is. That is how he talks is the thing. Oliver Stark's accent,
yeah.
Like American accent, is very four kids coded.
Well, I think I said in my video that he reminds me of kind of like a newsie's voice. Like it always feels like he's giving it a little Eastern twang. Which is funny. And I mean, his character is supposed to be from, what, Pennsylvania? So I guess it's not out of the question.
Hey, Crutchy, I'm going to Santa Fe.
I ain't gonna let nobody carry me, Jack. Okay. I do have a comment about Oliver Stark's voice in this episode specifically. I have a theory. I have a little conspiracy theory that maybe he got COVID either right before or right after filming this.
Ooh.
Because don't you think he sounds extra raspy in this episode?
He does a little bit. I just chalked it up to like, what if he was like, you know, he's English. So what if he like watched a football match and was like cheering really hard for Manchester United or whatever he does?
That could be it. But I was wondering if like maybe he got sick recently.
He may have. I don't know. So what I did before watching this episode is I went and watched the new episode, which I don't think either of us had any thoughts about, and definitely not on Twitter.
Well, we'll spare everyone our weekly Twitter drama. But yeah, basically, I just need to stop tweeting. Period. Because every time I make a tweet and it gets any attention, I feel my anxiety get so much worse, like on a very palpable, tangible level. And it's like I'm like touching the app that hurts me. And I know exactly what's happening and I can't stop doing it.
It's one thing to have.
I'm drinking the bone hurdy juice or whatever.
Buck Tommy's in your mention, like blowing up your spot, right? It's one thing to have Buck Tommy's coming at your neck, but when it's Eddie Diaz stands, like that just has like an extra sort of like bitter level of irony, because it's like, we don't hate Eddie.
Well, I just don't like how seriously everybody takes everything. Like I rattled off a joke literally when I was only halfway through the episode. So that was the other thing, is it started picking up steam like after everybody had seen the whole episode, and like my point was a little bit like less impactful in the grand scheme, which like I could have deleted it, but I don't know, it's just 911 Twitter. It's not like I like spread misinformation, so I wasn't trying to delete it. But suddenly I have all these people in my mentions like, wow, so you're saying people can't be gay and Catholic at the same time? And I'm like, show me where anyone said that. Like, I don't know where all this anger comes from. Like, why are you mad at me?
I would understand if these people were like homophobic and like getting like gay mad at you, but like they are also gay Eddie truthers. Like, we're on the same side here. It's just that everyone was theorizing about this being the gay Eddie-sode, and instead it's the, you know, Eddie, you know, embracing his Catholic heritage. And
and like, yes, it was more tasteful than usual. I'm not gonna, by the end of the episode, I was like, okay, fair enough. So I don't know, maybe people thought I was like being too harsh on it, but again, it was just a joke and I just made it halfway through the episode and I just thought, I had been seeing people theorizing all week that like, this is going to be the gay Eddie episode. And I didn't really believe that, but then watching the episode and seeing it go in this direction, again, it's not that religion is and gayness are mutually exclusive. It's more that, you know, culturally in a larger sense, Christian religion is often in opposition to queerness, and I
we don't
so
have
on
to
a very
justify
general
this.
Level.
We don't have to justify this. This
yes.
isn't
yeah,
this
that's...
isn't a thing that needs to be justified. No one is saying you can't be gay and Catholic at the same time.
You're correct.
Show me
and
the
really
words.
If these people want to see Ryan Guzman be Catholic so bad, I would direct them to the glorious 2019 film The Cleansing Hour. 2019? I think it was like 2021 or something.
It was like 2019, 2020. It doesn't matter because that movie was bad. But if you like bad things, then go watch it because he does get naked in it. So that's enjoyable. However, we are here to... welcome back to the First Verse podcast, by the way.
We are gathered here today to not get into our Twitter beef that doesn't matter, but instead to discuss season 4, episode 7 of 911, There Goes the Neighborhood, also the title of my favorite Sheryl Crow song. Now, this one was written by Stacey R. Rose and directed by Sharad Raju, and I don't know, I thought it was good.
It was good. I enjoyed it.
Let's end the episode there.
That's
story
it.
Story over.
I thought, no, I don't. When I say this episode was good, I'm excited to get into the complexities of it because it wasn't just good. It was also weird. This episode had weird things happen in it. I am looking forward to discussing them. The only thing I found objectionable, and it's right at the end, and I've said this before, can we stop with these closing monologues?
Oh, fair enough.
Can we stop
fair
with
enough.
These closing voiceover monologues? Neighbors.
To be fair, sorry. I do feel like Hen of all characters... for one thing has been doing that since the beginning, like we remember back in season 1 full moon hashtag creepy AF. Like, she's been here narrating, and I do feel like she has that kind of seriousness, gravitas as a character that actually kind of works for the monologues in a way that, like, it doesn't always. And I wouldn't mind the monologue, specifically we're talking about the narration. I wouldn't mind the narration on this show as much if they were just more consistent about it. Mm. Like, you know, for example, in this most recent episode in season 9, there was some Eddie narration, and it wasn't bad, other than the fact that any Ryan Guzman voiceover inevitably reminds me of the
anticipation of your presence.
Divine something energy. The linger of your aroma.
That will at once become reality.
Jesus. Other than the fact that I can't hear his voiceover without getting the ick, you know, I don't mind a good voiceover on this show as long as it has reason to be there, because obviously they can be very redundant. And I'm sure you could argue that it's redundant in this episode too, but I guess I'm saying it didn't feel... Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, like, objectionable to me, but yeah, it would be nice if they at least, like, used it as bookends in an episode instead of having Hen just randomly start narrating at the end of the episode after having done none of that for the rest of the episode.
Sorry, I just have to laugh. I just remembered how unserious this show used to be. Full moon, hashtag creepy AF.
Okay, the hashtag was my Mandela effect. Remember that. It wasn't actually called full moon hashtag creepy AF.
Wait, it
was
just wasn't?
No, right now I've Mandela affected you.
Oh,
this
my
was
God.
Our whole conversation with
Why
that
do
episode.
I remember
is...
it being that way?
It's just called, I'm pretty sure it's just called full moon creepy AF, which is
no, I think it's
still
in a parenthetical,
a
isn't it? Creepy AF
it
is in a parenthetical.
But for some reason, I had memory hold it to full moon hashtag creepy AF.
It's the Degrassi brain poisoning. It's the next class brain poisoning.
Ooh, yikes.
Yeah. I was just thinking about Degrassi the other day. I'm
sorry. I just remembered how bad the next class version of the theme song was, and I got like a little pang in my heart.
Whatever it takes, I know I can make it. I know I can make it through.
Like, why are we doing it in like a minor key? That always pissed me off.
Yeah. To this day, my favorite version is, it's actually, I don't think you like this version either. It's the one that they did this. They had, the in-universe band, the Stoods. The Stoods. That's my favorite version. I thought that was good.
I didn't like their like auto-tuned voices. I will always like the original with the children's choir
and the sort of
soulful vocal performance. I just think it's like the most uplifting and the one that's the most nostalgic for me.
Yeah, I just hate the one that's just fully instrumental and then on a bad green screen. That's like my least favorite
one.
It was
so 2008 though.
I hate 2008. I hate 2008.
Oh yeah, everybody does. But
I just,
you know,
don't bring me back to One Tree Hill. Just don't do it. Don't do it. I can't. Anyways,
I don't want to be anything other than what I've been trying
anyways,
to be.
Anyways, we're talking about There Goes the Neighborhood by Sheryl Crow and the episode that it inspired. We open this episode on a glorious
this
drone shot.
This lame-ass nerd-ass guy studying the Bible over
studying,
Zoom.
Studying the Bible. He's
who,
in a Bible study. A digital Bible study.
You get the sense that he is studying for like a class of some sort, so to be fair it could be like a theology course, but it's funny to imagine a guy in a Zoom college class where as the professor talks not just about the Bible but about like a very very basic passage of the Bible. This whole thing was clearly just an excuse to bring up neighbors as a theme early on because he's discussing the like love thy neighbor as thyself thing, but it's like what class? It's like Bible 101.
Yeah, it's like intro to religious studies. So, like this is the thing that Jesus
even.
Said
it's
that
like
one
intro
time.
To Jesus.
Yeah. and like I will say I don't want to harp on this guy too hard. I don't want to clown on him too hard because what if he's just gay and Catholic, you know? Like those people exist.
Are you saying that people can't be religious and gay?
I'm saying that. I'm saying that you shouldn't say that actually.
Fair.
This is Twitter. So he's being Jesus-y into his, you know, laptop or whatever on the digital religious studies class, whatever. And meanwhile, it's Freaky Friday. Oh, you know,
yes, his
I
mom.
Don't want to grow up. I don't want. Well, actually, she's not even singing that. She's singing a cover of Joan Jett's Bad Reputation.
Ooh. Yeah, so the mom of this young man is in a rock band, and it becomes clear that we've got like a role reversal here where the son has been parentified and the parent is immature.
Yeah, it's like a reveal.
She could just be like a fun-loving lady, and her son might just be an uptight loser.
That's what I was getting. I don't think he's being parentified here. I think he's just a dweeb and needs to learn to like rock out. Versus her, I feel like she is like, you know, of the generation that like, you know, is like sort of she grew up in a very countercultural way and then like stumbled her way into suburbia and found community with other moms. This is a mom band, by the way. It's called Mother Plague.
Yes.
He calls it Mother Courage, but it's the band is called Mother Plague. And it's like a band of like neighborhood moms.
They're rocking out in the garage. They're rocking out in the garage so hard that it's disturbing little Jesus boy's study session.
Well, imagine this being your son. Like if this was your son, would you even love him at that
so
point?
I'd be so disappointed.
I'd be so disappointed.
I would disown him.
Yeah. Like this is like what Lady Gaga meant when, you know, David Letterman asked her, if your child turned out to not be gay, would you still love him? And she goes, no. This is what she meant. So yeah. Not only are they rocking out to some classic Joan Jett, but they're also, oh my God, they're smoking the devil's lettuce. Guys,
they're smoking hot up in here.
I'm clutching my pearls so hard right now. My pearls, they're clutched.
It kind of just seems like the moms are like chill and having a good time and the son is like a total buzzkill. But yeah, he's like telling them to quiet down. He's so disappointed in his mom. I have to say, the actress playing the mom is in Lifetime movies. And specifically, she plays a mom in, I believe, both The Wrong Stepfather and The Wrong Mr. Right.
Ooh.
And she's pretty bad in both of them. But that was very exciting for me.
Jane's world, you know, it's so connected, you know. Like,
everything, her web connects them all.
Everything comes back to The Wrong movies.
And as the son, like, storms out because he's such a lame dweeb, one of the moms is like, hey, maybe we could unwind with a little help from this. She pulls out a pink joint, like pre-roll.
So,
which is interesting.
So I thought, and this is only for a second, I thought it was a tampon. Because sometimes they come in like those pink plastic containers. That's what I thought it was initially.
Nothing like a tampon, Ryan.
Well, no, but then I looked at it. I just saw the color and the vague shape of it. But then I saw it, I'm like, oh, it's a pink joint. And so I'm like, okay. Because I did not know where they were going with
that.
I'm sure. Okay. Anyways, he's putting his headphones on, like, you know, to go and, you know, do his Jesus stuff in the privacy of his mind. And we hear a deafening scream, but not like the rocker scream, more like a one of those. And he runs outside. Oh no, the moms are bleeding from their eyes and mouth and nose.
Everyone is bleeding from their face. They do a vertigo zoom on the guy and 911 call. I have to say, this is technically the 911 call that made me start watching this show. Because you'll recall,
you mentioned this.
Yeah, I first started watching it because I was watching a Red Letter Media video where they mentioned this show and how ridiculous it was, and they played this clip, and I was like, "That looks fun. That'll get my mind off my summer depression and burnout. I'll watch it." So really, I owe a lot to this episode.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that we have this full circle moment. How did it feel like for you to like sit here and watch this for the podcast now? Like how far we've come?
Honestly, not that crazy.
Damn.
But that being said, we never announced. It's been now over a year of this podcast. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, we missed that.
It's like whatever. We're so nonchalant about it.
We've had a lot going on. Okay, we have both had a very busy year, haven't we? You know, and so I just want to say on the pod, you know, thank you guys for a full year's worth of support and some change. Very belated 1 year anniversary. Thank you guys for your time. You know, and this has been such a fun labor of love and now money. So thank you guys. It's been great.
And you know, we haven't gotten Oliver Stark on the pod yet, but it'll happen. Mm-hmm. Right? It'll happen.
Hey, it'll happen. And in the meantime, you know, we'll always have, you know, Justin and Kyla and Brooklyn to, you know.
Exactly. Those are our celebrities.
Those are our celebrities. And, you know, Devin Kelly, never heard of her. You know, Oliver Stark, who? Right?
Who?
Although he is starring, and this was exciting news, he is starring in an upcoming short film. He's finally working on another project again.
He's finally got a job outside of 911. You know, just a short film. I don't mean to denigrate the medium of short films, but
I'm surprised it didn't come for you for that instead of Kay and Catholic. It shows the priorities of this fandom.
Nobody in the 911 fandom seems to have any idea how film and television production work, but yeah, short films, they just tend not to reach as many people distribution wise and that means they can be a little more difficult to really engage with, but mm-hmm. You know, maybe it'll go to festivals.
I mean, it could be like that gay Pedro Pascal Ethan Hawke movie short film that I watched and enjoyed many times.
Yeah, but that was
Almodovar. Times.
That's kind of different.
That's
like,
true.
Like, people watch a short if Almodovar makes it.
Well, maybe it'll go on
Almodovar
YouTube.
Almodovar should make a short starring Ryan Guzman and Oliver Stark.
Oh, my God. Honestly, I'm so over Ryan Guzman. I'm sorry. I can't.
Like, oh, no, me to, too.
It needs to star Anirudh Pichirodi. It needs to, like, it needs to, I'm honestly, now that, like, you know, Eddie is over, I'm into Buck Ravi. I've jumped
ships. Now
that
Eddie is over. So you've just fully, like, Ryan Guzman and Eddie are one and the same to you?
I'm just saying, like, I'm throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I am.
Damn.
You know, like, this is done for me. It's dead in my heart and my soul. And you know what it was that killed it? For not just for Ryan Guzman, but for Eddie. Because, like, Ryan Guzman died with the transphobia. Eddie died with the... your presence. I can't take his voice seriously anymore. I can't do it. I'm sorry.
I mean,
it's
I can't
over.
Say that that's not fair. I can't say that that's not fair, but I also can't say I quite agree. I'm still Team Eddie, but we are on slightly thin ice. Anyway, back to it. So they call 911. Guy is like, they're bleeding from their faces. The 118 arrives.
In hazmat
and
suits.
Uh-oh. They're all wearing hazmat suits, which freaks out what's-his-name so bad that he faints. But they start going around to these moms, and they're actually not feeling too bad. They clearly are stoned, and they're all kind of, you know, if I was in this situation high, I feel like I would be so freaked out and not having a good time anymore. Because, like, a bunch of people in hazmat suits are, like, and I'm bleeding from my eyes. Like, I would probably already be dead of a heart attack. But these ladies are really taking it in stride and kind of just continue not letting it kill their buzz. And I have to respect that.
Yeah, I have to respect that. Maybe that sort of fortitude comes with age. And we'll get there, you know, when we are suburban parents with religious children. So they're going to all the moms. They're high as fuck. They give the guy smelling salts in order to revive him, basically. And he narcs on them. He narcs on them, and mom gets upset. This is actually a real moment of, like, the child being parentified, because the mom gets upset, calls him a narc. But he says, you know, they're high as fuck. They inspect the pink joint, and apparently it's from a online dispensary called Puffer's Paradise that courted controversy because they sell synthetic weed that is laced with rat poison.
Which, like, how are they still in... How has this thing not been shut down already?
Maybe it's like the Silk Road, and it's so decentralized that shutting it down is going to take some time. Or maybe it's maybe they stockpiled.
Rock Band moms accessing it then?
Maybe they got it at Costco. I don't know. But it turns out they've been passing the pink joints around the neighborhood. They've been giving it
to neighbors. Generous. I hope she's been asking people to pay her back.
Maybe
she's just been handing them out like candy. Like,
maybe she's just like, this is part of
Jenkins
her,
down
you know,
the street
deal
for his back pain.
Yeah, Miss What's Your Face for her anxiety. This dude for his arthritis. You know. Oh, and this guy across the street just because. And so they're like, oh, there goes the neighborhood. Drink. I will actually drink water.
For a lot. Well, can we also mention that Eddie gets, like, mad sexually harassed by one of the women in the band? She thinks he's hot. And then by the end of the scene, Buck and Eddie are, like, walking away to start going door to door, asking people if they've had these joints. And she just, like, slaps Eddie's ass.
She does? Oh, I missed that.
Yeah. Not recognized who was who in the masks. But yeah.
Oh, wow.
So Eddie, like, you know, are you good? that was inappropriate.
It was inappropriate. Wow, I'm feeling for Eddie. You know what? I'm back on Eddie's side. Buddy's alive again. This is our buddy season. The only one who should be slapping his ass is Buck. Anyways, speaking of...
Say that again, brother.
Speaking of... Title card, Buck is on a date.
Buck is on a date. I'm sorry. I love this scene so much. This diva.
Oh my God.
Buck, okay. Did you guys ever see that SNL sketch that they used to do on Weekend Update? This is like when I was in my prime of watching SNL when I was like 15. They would do this sketch on Weekend Update where Colin Jost would be hosting and Cecily Strong would play this character called the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party. And the joke is that she's this not very informed, but very passionately, like, trying to kind of be woke all the time. But the joke wasn't just, like, woke bad, because the joke was that she wasn't even very, she didn't even really know what she was talking about. But she would just take everything as, like, wow, you would say that in 2016 or something. This girl that Buck is on a date with is the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party. Not only is she offended by everything, all innocuous things, but she is just very negative in general and doesn't seem to even want... It's very... You have to wonder, like, how this date even got set up, because she really doesn't seem like she would like to be on a date with anyone ever.
Yeah, because he's okay. So first of all, can I just say, I don't want to pin it all on her. Buck is on a first date telling the poop story. He
kind of
is
a crazy thing to bring
recounting
up.
The tale of the first date
over
gone wrong
dinner too
over
like,
dinner
save it for some other time.
I will say, though, maybe she's a freak because she does order the chocolate cheesecake after this. So maybe that put her in the mood. I don't know. And I don't know her life. However, I will say this woman sucks. She sucks in a very...
No. I love her.
It feels like kind of a passe, sort of pastiche of, like, you know, third wave BuzzFeed pop feminism. No, it's very like,
yeah, 2015, 2016. But basically her whole thing is, you know, Buck will be telling the poop story. And then she's like, wow, so this woman was just, it's like, this woman really did all that because she felt like she couldn't, you know, let a man know what was really going on with her. Or like she's talking about how she moved to LA wanting a fresh start, and Buck's like, well, here you are, like, let's toast to that. And she's like, wow, we're really gonna toast a woman's humiliation. Like, I was loving, I don't know, I love my overly woke queen. I love that she's being so rude and uncalled for to Buck. I think it's very funny.
I just know she went to the new school. I just know she just tears it up in this sort of very performative way. But this isn't performative. This is just who she is. And you can tell by the conviction of her words.
That's what's so wonderful about it.
Yeah, I know. It's just, I would never want to have a conversation with her.
But like, I would admire her from afar.
Sure.
Be like, do your thing, diva.
There is, this is really funny. I do love that, you know, when they get dessert, they order dessert and Buck's like, oh, do you want to share? And she's like, that's presumptuous. And then he's like, yeah, sure. Two slices of the chocolate cheesecake. And
so
then,
uncalled for. And to be then, fair. Yeah, then he's like, oh, I guess we're going to have to do some extra cardio after this. And she's like, did you just body shame me? Which... I would not go so far as to make the body shaming comment. However, that comment from Buck would have given me the ick too. I don't like that kind of thing where people are like, oh, I'm having dessert. I'm going to have to work these calories off later. It's like, shut the fuck up.
It was joking.
But this does make sense from...
He was joking.
It doesn't matter. I don't like the joke. It does make sense coming from measures his exact body fat percentage, Buck Buckley. Possibly has had an eating disorder, Buck Buckley.
But you also know for a fact that Buck would never body shame another person.
Well, no, but it's like I would get the ick from him talking that way about himself, you know?
You would get the ick from being on a date with a man, first of all. Like, let's
well,
start there.
Yeah, but I'm putting myself in her shoes, okay? I'm empathizing. I'm being an empath.
I'm just saying, I'm just saying, if Buck said that to me, I would have started, like, I would have just, like...
You would be like, we can do some cardio.
Yeah, I would have played it off. I would have played it off. That's all I'm saying. Because I would have actually been into him.
Good for you for having so much Buck game.
Pick me, Buck.
Pick me. Choose me. Love
me.
We go back to the Wilson household where these damn kids are always on their damn phones because Denny and Nia are fighting over the singular iPad. And Karen's like, we might have to become a two iPad household. But, you know, Hen's trying to get them to bed. They're trying
Nia
to sort
wants
out this
to watch
whole thing.
Peppa Pig specifically. She wants she to watch Peppa Pig. And Denny wants to play his little video games. But yeah, they're like, we need to put you guys to bed. Denny's like, can we read the story on the iPad? Karen's like, no. They're full iPad babies at this point. There's a knock on the door. Who should it be? Oh, wait. I just burped. I'm so sorry if anyone heard that. Not my feelings on the arrival, by the way. Because on the other side of the door... It's Hen's mom. Grammy's home.
It's Tony.
Tony. Okay.
Yeah, I couldn't remember if Hen's mom had made an appearance on the show before. Has she?
She has. Yeah, we've met her before.
Like, okay.
This is like the star of like her becoming like a proper recurring character.
More of a character, yeah.
And
so yes, Hen's mom has shown up unannounced. We hear that she usually lives in Las Vegas, and she's like, yeah, I just decided to come down. Hen's like, wow, I can't believe you didn't call. But
Four
Tony
hours
is
on the
like,
road,
don't worry
you
about
know.
Me. Yeah, don't worry about me. I've already got my Airbnb sorted out. Like, I'm not going to be staying here. And, you know, I'll be there until I figure out where to, until I find a place of my own. And Hen's like, wait, how long are you staying? And she says, permanently. So Mama Hen is relocating to LA.
Can we talk about the fact that Toni is perfect casting as Hen's mom? Like the actress who plays her?
No, I always think it's so adorable that they decided to style Hen's mom exactly the same as Hen.
Yeah,
like she's
so
just
nice.
Also got a shaved head and the glasses, and like they both wear the kind of like streetwear style.
Mm-hmm. You can see
like,
where Hen
oh,
gets
it's a bigger
it's
Hen
so perfect.
Just
it's just older Hen is here, right? It's so sweet.
Let's be Hen with Mama.
I love Toni so much, and I am excited about this, even though they are not. In fact, they're thrilled. Karen and Hen, as Toni goes inside, Karen and Hen are like, oh, I'm sure it'll be fine. Will it?
Yeah, it seems like Hen is, it doesn't seem like she like hates her mom or anything, but it's just that sort of understandable thing as an adult where she's like, I like my mom, but I don't love the idea of her just moving to my city unannounced.
Yeah.
You know, this thing where we're gonna have to, you know, she might become a much bigger part of my life. I don't know if I'm ready for that, whatever.
Yeah, if my dad up and decided to just move to New York one day without telling me, I would probably be a little upset about it. especially if he like moved to like, you know, the same neighborhood as me or something. So yeah, they're thrilled and we understand why. Buck body shames his date and then goes home. Albert is watching TV.
Albert.
Exactly. And he's watching specifically like dating TV. He's watching like what,
it's some kind of like dating advice show, I think.
Yeah, because as we all know, his biggest priority in life is just, you know, the game. And he's so like, as soon as Buck walks
kind of
in,
like,
he's gloomy and glowery.
Kind of like with Albert, I guess we did get a hint in the last season that Albert was more of a like hookup culture kind of guy, but I feel like by this point it seems like he has this very charming, just like earnest interest in love.
Yeah.
Like, I guess kind of like Buck, but kind of with fewer hangups. He seems like he just genuinely loves to be dating and in love and is just
he's so Pookie
in a
Bear.
Very uncomplicated way, just wants to pursue that.
He's so Pookie Bear. He's just gay for women. And he, you know, he is interested in like sort of the, like the, I guess you could say the act of dating. He's interested in like sort of all the things that go into it. It's just his little special interest is just getting it in.
Special interest being dating. That sounds like such a nightmare.
I know.
But he peeps the chocolate cheesecake that Buck brought home. I love the idea of Buck eating like one bite of that cheesecake and then being like, I'm having such a bad time on this date that I can't even eat another bite of cheesecake. I have to box it up and take it home.
Maybe he got self-conscious about the poop story. But then he, and by the way, Albert insists on Buck giving him a fork in this very cute way. And Buck is just like so not having it because all he wants to do is vent about this horrible date. And then Albert's just there smiley, none the wiser to his like emotional state. He's just like, give me a fork.
Right.
Give me a fork. I want to tear into this cheesecake.
This is such a like roommate thing. Buck is like, the trash smells awful. And Albert's like, oh, it's your turn to take it out. And he tries to say like, my dating show lady says that after a date you should think about one good thing and one bad thing you learned from the experience. And Buck is getting ready to take out the trash. He's like, bad thing, everything. Good thing, never have to see this girl again. Uh-oh. Buck walks out of the apartment with the trash. Who is in the hallway walking out of her apartment also with a bag of trash? It's Veronica, the lady you wish you hadn't started a conversation with on your date. Buck, continuing to take out the trash, he runs back into the apartment. Albert asks what's wrong, and Buck, dead serious, says, we have to move.
This is what people mean when they say this show is a sitcom. This is a sitcom scenario.
Yeah, no, this is a very sitcom scenario.
And Albert's just is standing there with his little glass of oat milk, and you can tell it's oat milk by the packaging. And it's just, it's so, I love this show. It's so funny. It's so funny. And so, yeah, I love this whole mini storyline we have in this episode. Now we cut to Michael, who is letting Athena and Harry into the apartment. And look at those windows. First of all, he has done some renovating on this apartment.
Yes, he's created this huge skylight, basically.
Mm-hmm. And it's very cool. Like, you can definitely tell, like, he designed it too. Like, this is a man mm-hmm. who is deeply bored. And so he's
but
like,
also,
let me renovate my own apartment.
I don't see any blinds on those skylights. So it's like, I guess you have to have light in the apartment forever and no yeah. privacy.
Is that so wrong? Sunlight, the joy
no,
of the
I'm,
open
mostly
air.
I'm thinking about the privacy part. But
oh, yeah.
whatever.
Well, we know Michael doesn't care about that. Well, we know he doesn't care about that because of what we learn about him in this episode.
So Michael's got a bit of a new hobby, which is yeah. spying on his neighbors. He's gotten this telescope, and with his giant windows, he just Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window style just looks out his windows and looks at, into all the windows across the way. And just like Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo, I mean Rear Window, Jesus, Rear Window, we're not quite at the Vertigo storyline yet. Wait for season 7. Just like Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window, he's kind of come up with little identities and stories for all these people in his various windows. So he shows Athena, and she actually seems to be getting into it. Mm-hmm. He's like, that's Miles, the guy who runs on the treadmill, and that's what's her name, who paints pictures and doesn't like them, and that's Slim. I call him that because he's kind of shady. His mysterious, suspicious thing is that he generates a lot of trash.
Yeah.
And Athena's like, come on, that's not that big of a deal. But Michael's really intent on figuring out what's with all the trash bags that he's always taken out of his apartment.
So here's the thing. Watching this storyline, I feel like I'm living in an alternate universe where this isn't a crime. is this not a crime to spy on your neighbors like this?
Probably, but we know that Athena is not averse to bending the rules for her close her.
I am going to Google it right now because like it's one thing to like, you know, like every now and again steal a glance at your neighbor's windows, and it's another thing to have a telescope.
No, I'm sure it is illegal in some sense, possibly, but yeah, I don't think Athena was about to like call it in. It's Michael. That would have been funny if she was like, all right, cuffs out, you're coming with me.
Okay, so apparently, it is primarily illegal when there is surveillance involved, like recording surveillance involved. So if it's just a telescope without like a little blinking red
okay.
dot attached to
watching,
it,
that's okay.
then it's objectionable, but like legally, like they can't necessarily do anything about it. Cause I feel like that would be impossible to try in court. Like he'd have plausible deniability.
Yeah.
Oh, I use the telescope to look at the stars through my giant ceiling windows that
and
I just had
installed.
It just
seems a bit like too much of an infringement on people's personal freedom to be like, you can't watch things from your own home.
Right, but it's still he's still a peeping Tom, right? Like
that's not really the point. We're yeah. validating this behavior in this episode.
Because it does
Athena
lead to a very
like,
funny and interesting storyline.
Yes.
Yeah.
Athena is like, no offense, but you seem a little like you have too much time on your hands. So like, how's work?
Devastating.
Have you been doing anything lately? And Michael is like, well, you know, it's COVID. Like a lot of my contracts that I would usually have kind of dried up. Like nobody's really in the market for like office buildings right now. And mm-hmm. he mentions also that, you know, last year when he was diagnosed with cancer, he made a bucket list. And then when he found out he was clean, he was like free of cancer, he made a second
clean
list.
Is crazy.
Was like, okay,
clean is
okay,
crazy.
Okay, I didn't mean to imply. I realized as soon as I said it that I had used the wrong word.
The wrong word.
No, once Michael found out that he was cancer-free, mm-hmm. in remission, you could say,
mm-hmm.
he decided to make kind of a living bucket list, where now that he's got this new link on... What am I even saying? Now that he's got this new link on life.
Yo,
now that he's
yo,
got
he's
this
put
new...
in the Ethernet cable. He's locked in.
Now that he has hacked into the mainframe of his new lease on life, he wants to go out and do some things that he might not have thought of doing before. He wants to travel. He wants to do all this stuff. But now that COVID lockdown is happening, he's not really able to do any of those things. So he's feeling really cooped up. and a little
aimless. This is what I'm saying. Okay, no, this is what I'm saying when I say this show incorporated COVID into its storyline better than any other television show.
No,
this
truly,
show
it's
incorporated
really natural.
It so well into its storyline that feels so grounded in the real world.
Yeah, because like in real life, people's lives did go on and a lot of people were still going to work and still going about their lives, but there were just a lot of larger things that you couldn't do, like traveling, and a lot of people mentally were suffering just from this general sense of kind of complacency and not being able to do anything really that different, falling into a rut in your life.
Yeah, and so now he's just waving through a window.
Exactly.
So here's the thing. We don't get to linger on that or, you know, the post-tumor boredom because there is a felony assault in progress. Maddie answers a 911 call. A very distressed neighborhood couple is reporting a felony assault. There's slashes, there's scratches. It's a whole thing. So, of course, you know, the 118 responds to take care of the injured people. And this mystery assailant is on the loose, terrorizing the neighborhood. Meanwhile,
his name's Sonny.
Sonny is the assailant's name. Hen is talking about how, you know, having mom back in town isn't the best. It's not great. And Chim's like, how do you feel about that? And she's like, not good. And then Buddy is Veronica debriefing. And then Eddie's like, how was the date? And Buck was like, bad. And he's like, how do you feel about that? And he's like, well, I felt fine until I found out she was my neighbor. And Albert had to distract her for 20 minutes while I was getting my mail. He had to distract her for 20 minutes while I was getting my mail. How long does it take to get the mail?
That just occurred to me that every character in this episode is pretty much living through like a Seinfeld plot.
Literally, literally
some of
a
them
Seinfeld
are executed,
plot.
Some of them are executed more seriously than others, but like on paper, what? Hen's mom is in town and she might be sticking around for a little while. Buck went on a bad date with a weird girl and she lives in his building.
I just
Who
I
else?
Need to...
Oh, Michael is spying on his funky neighbor.
I need the scene transitions to be like, you know, Chimney doing like fucking like stand up, like bad stand up. Which, oh, by the way, can I just say, I thought the whole joke in Seinfeld was that Jerry's stand up was bad, and that was the whole point.
I think it's up to interpretation.
But that was just Jerry Seinfeld earnestly doing stand up.
Oh yeah, he's not funny. He's not.
He's
good
not
at
a funny guy at all. And so I thought that was the joke because the whole point of the show is that they're horrible people, right? And so like, oh, he's also a horrible comedian, but he thought he was like spitting fire that entire show. Deeply embarrassing for Israel's strongest soldier Jerry Seinfeld. But how
anyway.
Do you think, wait, hold up, we're already here, how do you think Chimney would do at stand-up? I feel like he would kill.
I think he would kill. I think he would destroy at stand-up.
I agree. I have to agree.
I wouldn't be surprised if Kenny Choi has done stand-up before.
The amount of stories he would have to tell, he would just be like an observational comic, like telling stories from his life. He has so many. And he would always end his set on just like a cliffhanger of how he got his name, but we'd never hear. We'd never hear.
Oh, that'd be
but
such
the
a good
audience
gimmick.
Would hear. What a gimmick. What a gimmick. Hen explains that, you know, she and her mom are very close. They have a good relationship when they're living 4 hours away across state lines. But it's one of those relationships where, like, they just really don't live together because her mom has this bad habit of, like, overstepping and upturning her life by, you know, second-guessing everything she does, etc.
Yeah,
and,
Hen refers to her as a bulldozer.
Yeah, exactly. She even apparently still buys her like dresses every holiday. Now,
right. And
to
she
the listeners.
Says to Chimney and Bobby, she says, "Have you ever seen me in a dress?" And they kind of look at each other. And then the guy they're treating, the guy who's been slashed, kind of meekly goes, "I think you'd look lovely in a dress." Such a funny joke.
Maybe holding like, a case filled with prototype pharmaceuticals and a bad wig on, you know, like maybe you just go back to your old life, Hen.
Right. But it's like you don't get the sense that this guy is being like lecherous or weird. It seems like he's just trying to give her a compliment in a way that's kind of
He's an older guy too. Maybe he was just like thought he was being like very like, you know, like, you know, courteous.
I think he thinks he's being helpful somehow.
Yeah, you know, he's had a big day, and we find out why, because Buddy is you know, talking about Veronica, and then Eddie gets a sneaking suspicion that their assailant is behind them. What do they hear?
Eddie goes, "He's right behind me, isn't he?"
What do they hear? And then who should walk out from behind the bush but a goddamn turkey?
Oh my god, happy Thanksgiving, everyone. We're
happy
getting up to Thanksgiving
time.
No, I love this moment. I find it very relatable because actually in my neighborhood, we have a lot of wild turkeys and they freak me out because I have heard, you know, they seem like unpredictable birds. I don't want to get slashed by a turkey. And they kind of just travel in flocks around here, especially in the summer and fall. And so sometimes you'll see like a line of cars will be stopped because like, they've got to wait for the turkeys to cross the road. I live in a metropolitan area, by the way. I don't live in like bumfuck Minnesota, but for some reason the wild turkeys are still running rampant around here.
Have you ever been to an organized turkey shoot? I've always been curious about those.
No.
Like in the Thanksgiving season. Like that's
but
a
I
thing.
Was just rewatching the season 2 episode of Grey's Anatomy where George's family shows up and they force him to go turkey hunting with
pick
them.
Pick a car, Georgie.
And being all like
pick
annoying
a car.
And macho.
Mm-hmm.
I literally, oh my god, I can't believe you remember it so well. I feel so bad about the character of George O'Malley because I just know, you know, T.R. Knight is gay, and mm-hmm. the impression you get from George as a character is like, oh, if you had been written in the 2020s, you would have been allowed to be gay.
He would have been gay so hard. He would,
but because the character was written in 2005, he has to be just this kind of awkwardly positioned in the story straight nerd character.
And we know Alex isn't homophobic. They could have had like a cool, like, you know, gay straight best friends thing going on with Alex, the straightest guy to ever exist, and George, the sweet gay doctor played by, you know, T.R. Knight, who, by the way, I
do hate Alex, but only because of what happens later in the show when he like beats up a guy and almost kills him because of a simple misunderstanding. And for some reason, his girlfriend stays with him after that.
See, I never saw that part. I just don't like Alex because of his personality. I did meet T.R. Knight once. I met him once. And I was shocked by how short he is in person. He's a short king. He looks 20 years older than he did on the show because he is. It was an all day event. So he looked so tired. I was embarrassed to even be speaking to him, but he was very nice. But like, I'm just like, I don't want to make you feel worse than you already do.
Wow. So what a backhand. You just met him and thought he looked extremely tired and worn out.
I mean, oh my god, you should have seen like the bags under his eyes and like the faraway look that he was carrying around with him.
T.R. Knight, don't hold it against us. Come on the pod.
Come on the pod, T.R. We love you. We love you and gay George O'Malley. But
do you think people refer to him as T.R.? Like, do people just call him T.R. in his
What's his name?
In his personal life?
I mean, what's his name?
See, right? It's just T.R.
Well, we know Washington calls him T.R.
Getting off track. So Buck and Eddie have this great moment where, like, Western music starts playing and they, like, turn around with... Eddie's holding this, like, net shooter thing. So they trap the
it's standard issue. Every fire department has one. Right.
Of course, of course. And they trap the turkey.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him. We got him.
Yes. And the guy who called it in is like really sad. He's like, oh, I just never thought it would turn out this way. He was the neighborhood pet. Never let them get too close. To which Buck and Hen both go, exactly. And they also raise this
two
idea
dumb
to
bitches.
Chimney.
Two dumb bitches telling each other exactly.
Exactly. Well, also, like, Chimney says something about, like, that's why I don't get to know my neighbors or something. And everybody else is like, well, you'll know them soon. because you're about to have a baby in an apartment building. Like, everybody's going to be knocking on your door, like, whatever, all the noise. And so that means that, whatever.
That's true. No, that's so true. That's so true. I mean, like, having a baby low-key is, like, the worst parts about having a dog. Or, like, your neighbors having a dog. You know, like, the barking, the smell, right. The up at weird hours in the yard or whatever.
I think, ideally, if you're taking good care of your baby, I don't think there should be a smell that's bad enough to seep through the walls of your apartment building.
Tell
to the
that to Alan Grant. Okay, tell that to Mr. Jurassic Park himself. I will not argue with Sam Neill, you know?
I could not remember who that was for a moment.
You don't remember that scene at the beginning of Jurassic Park when Ellie and Alan are walking up that giant hill and they're talking about how much Alan hates babies and he goes, they smell. Some of them smell. Babies smell, you know?
Well, no, I'm not saying they don't smell. I'm just saying if they were smelly enough for like the neighboring apartments to be able to smell, that'd be pretty bad.
Maybe you catch a
Your
whiff.
Baby might
I don't
have
know.
A disease.
None of my neighbors have babies. So, you know, thank God for that. Although my downstairs neighbor does have a dog. I just moved into my new apartment and my downstairs neighbor has a dog and he's so cute. We had to meet him to go through his apartment to get to the thing while we were setting up our Wi-Fi. And his dog is so cute. His name is Jules. Little Jules the dog. He's like a little, you know, schnauzer or whatever. And he's so sweet and he was jumping on me. Oh, Jules. Jules is so nice.
Okay, well, if he's not going to be a guest on the podcast, then I'm not interested.
That's true. Let's get back to the Michael peeping Tom storyline.
Yes. Michael is peeping in his apartment and he gets a call from May, who's like, hey, Dad, what are you up to? And Michael is trying to beat around the bush. I guess he doesn't feel comfortable just telling his daughter that he's being a peeping Tom. And so he's like, yeah, I'm just doing some stuff around the house. I'm doing a laundry or whatever. And May's like, maybe I should come over for dinner. You know, I just want to spend some time with you. And Michael is immediately on to her. He's like, did your mother put you up to this? And May's like, no, I just want to hang out. And they ultimately end the conversation. Michael sees that some development is happening across the street in the Slim Shady apartment. Mm-hmm. So he hastily hangs up on May. They actually don't conclude whether or not they're going to have dinner together, which I would be stressed about. I would be like, yeah. Dad, am I coming over or am I not?
But the development in question, by the way, is that he has blood on his hands and he's washing it off in the sink. So, you know, jot that down.
Yeah, which, like, that's not what you want to see your neighbor doing.
Yeah, especially with all those trash bags. But yeah, May hangs up and it's fucking, like, it's like she's Hannah Baker in Knives Out, fucking Catherine Langford and herself, because Athena put her up to it and was listening in on the call the whole time. And so now May is like, what are we going to do now? And Athena's like, time for plan B. She's like, what's plan B? Athena's like, not what. Who? Oh, they're getting an inside man. Oh, they're getting an inside
plan
man
B
with an inside
for
Bobby.
Plan.
Ooh, plan B for Bobby. R.I.P. Now, we go from that to, okay, so I hate homeowners associations, and I hate the people who are obsessed with the homeowners association, because this nice dad is putting up a beautiful pirate-themed playset for his children. It looks so good.
It's like a
treehouse
combined
done.
With a ship.
It's crazy. So cool. And this male Karen, is there a word for those? Is there a word for a male Karen? It's this old crotchety-ass guy, a man, a white man, is harassing
right,
his
ladies?
Black neighbor, you know, and he's like, this is not 3 feet from the thing. And he's like, I thought there was a clause that said if there was an alleyway, it didn't have to be 3 feet from the property line. And he's like, that's not an alleyway. That's my patio. You need to move the goddamn ship. And he's like, don't worry. It'll
leave.
Be great. You need to leave. It'll liven up the neighborhood. And as they're arguing about it,
well, he also says, hey, your grandkids can play with it when they come over. And the guy's like, my grandkids are in college, which I just want to say, if I were his grown-up grandchild, I would still want to play on the pirate ship thing. It looks awesome.
It does
look
awesome.
It's so elaborate.
It's
like a whole theme park attraction or something.
It sounds fantastic, you know, and like...
I would be like, yeah, I need a break from, college is hard. Maybe I want to hang out on a pirate ship for a little bit.
What if I want to go on the swings? You know, whatever happened to the swings, right? But as they're, you know, going back and forth about this, you hear this...
like a plane overhead. and they see something in the sky that they realize they need to run from, which they try to do, but the old guy like hits his head on part of the boat as he's trying
like
to run.
Mast.
So he falls down and a big car falls on him. I must say, first of all, one, I hate the US military. Two, I am so obsessed with how convoluted of a premise we have on this call. Because think about it. First, we have these neighbors disagreeing over this like ship-shaped playset, which is already kind of an obscure idea. It's like, what yeah. is this? And then you assume some emergency is going to have to do with the ship itself. But then we hear
maybe
like,
they need to go to sea and this
like,
is the only
okay.
ship available.
you hear a plane overhead and you're like, oh, what? You know, there could be so many different plane related emergencies. And then a car falls from the sky. It just feels kind of like they didn't like I love it for being so weird and so convoluted. But it kind of feels like, you know, they didn't have like one concept. They kind of have this whole winding series of things.
For our listeners at home who don't watch the show but listen to this podcast, first of all, shout out to you guys. second of all, I should clarify, it's not like a Toyota Corolla or anything. It's a military Humvee.
It's a Humvee.
It's like, and it's got a parachute attached to it.
Basically a car, okay?
I mean, yeah, it's a car. It's just like, it's an armored car with bulletproof glass.
It's not a Honda Civic.
It's not a Honda Civic. So we get a 911 call from a sergeant in the U.S. Army. It turns out they accidentally deployed an airdrop of a Humvee with its little attached parachute.
We've made an oopsie from our military plane.
I mean, it literally was that.
We dropped a Humvee out of a plane onto a civilian property. Like, I'm sorry. And this is not even the only time this type of thing happens on the show, because I'm pretty sure at the top of season 7, there's a kind of similar thing that happens where, like, a military plane crashes into somebody's house, right? And the military has to show up and be like, yeah, that was our bad.
And they face no consequences.
And I assume both of these were based on real events, because I haven't heard of like specifically these types of ones, but I do happen to know, I did some research on this for my Purple Hearts video of all things. The military is kind of like extremely negligent at times when it comes to like training exercises, and actually a lot of soldiers die just in training exercises that are happening like at home. And so I don't know, I just was like, wow, that's interesting that they would just have like something this insanely negligent on the part of the US military happen on the show more than once. And yeah, there's never any acknowledgement of like, huh, how did that happen?
I'm sorry, no shade to the soldiers, but like that's the ultimate, like you win, you play stupid games, you win stupid prizes, you sign up die gloriously in battle and fucking get shot during a training exercise. Well, how do you explain that to your family? You know, like,
it's
Purple
not getting
Heart.
Shot. There was like a feature about it on 60 Minutes. It's the one that I researched anyway, is that they would do these, and I believe still do, these exercises with amphibious vehicles, the ones that can go on land and in the water. And they take them down into the water and they just have all these accidents where, like, you know, the vehicles can't come back up or something. And so a lot of people like drown or suffocate in those types of accidents.
That's because soldiers are expendable meat puppets to these people. It's just a machine, you know, so
and that's
surprise,
why
surprise.
You should just take out student loans instead of getting preyed on by the U.S. military. But
exactly. Or
anyway.
Go to trade school, be a plumber or an electrician or something. There's no shortage.
Yeah,
there's a shortage of those. And there's a shortage of plumbers in this country right now.
Stop becoming influencers and soldiers. We need gaffers.
We need gaffers, and we need people to fix the goddamn pipes. Now, I will say,
we need people. No, I'm saying we need people to go like do lighting for John M. Chu movies or whatever.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I will say, the 118 responds, and I just like after like the way this guy just freaked out on his neighbor, it feels so good to see him in pain. It really does.
You could say karma's a bitch.
Karma's a bitch, right? Eddie,
I should have known better.
Eddie, the army boy that he is, explains military training protocols with airdrops and shit. No one cares. We breeze past it. I care
about one thing that he says, because I'm pretty confident the line in the script was, he's supposed to say, it's how the military gets supplies, aid, and everything else. But he doesn't say that. He says, it's how the military gets supply, aids, and everything else.
Well...
And I guess they didn't get another take.
Well, maybe no one caught it, or maybe they only caught it in post, and they just didn't care.
Maybe they were like, "Who gives a shit? Nobody's gonna be nitpicking these episodes 5 years from now."
Yeah, they never make it past season two, anyways. So you know, it's fine.
This podcast never lasts. Well, yes. So Eddie says that this is how the military gets AIDS, and and then we, as they're trying to figure out how to get this guy out of this situation, he's actually kind of giving Buck at the end of season two, because his leg has been crushed under a vehicle. I was wondering in this scene, I was like, ooh, is Buck like getting flashbacks? Is he being re-traumatized by this situation of a guy having his leg crushed under a vehicle? It doesn't seem like
it. You know what? There are 36,000 buddy fics out there. I'm sure someone's written one with that in mind.
Buck goes home traumatized after the children's playhouse that looks like a pirate ship call.
Now Larry David head ass is crushed. Yeah, they realize that, you know, in order to get him out there, they, you know, they don't have a lot of options,
like Larry David.
So they're gonna have to use the Humvee's parachute, tie it to the ladder of the ladder truck, and then just like get it off of him and pull him
out.
They're
gonna basically pick up the Humvee by the scruff of its neck and just pull it off of the guy, which they do.
Like the little puma it is.
They manage to get the guy out in time. And also, as they start doing this, there's a Sloop John B needle drop, because I guess they were just like, what's a song about a boat? And that was all they could come up with.
And they couldn't do Lonely Island.
Yeah.
They get him out, and tense peace is achieved across property lines, because you know, apparently the boat actually softened the impact and ended up saving the guy's life, it looks like. And so the guy who built the boat, the dad, is like, see, it's gonna be even better, and he's like 3 feet from the property line, like he's like going to his grave, and like it'll be etched on his tombstone, I said 3 feet from the property line. Whatever. At least he's not going to have to hear from him for a little while. Now, that's all good and done. Presumably the military came to, you know, collect their scraps, and Buck is over at Madney's doing baby stuff. They're setting up...
They're putting together these adorable little care packages for their neighbors, full of, like, melatonin and earplugs and liquor to... as a peace offering to say, hey, if we end up making a lot of noise with our stupid baby in a few months, you know, here's a little bit of equipment to help you sleep, hopefully. Which I would be very... I think I'd be pleased if my neighbors did an offering like that. My only worry would be, like, okay, is this supposed to be, like... I would be worried that maybe they would have an attitude that like, okay, since we gave these care packages, we don't have to ever worry about being loud again, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, knowing them, like what we know about Maddie and Chimney, like that's not the case.
Yeah.
But if I was the neighbor, I would be suspicious.
That this was like almost doing a little too much in a way that feels maybe overcompensatory for what they plan to, how much noise they plan to make. Yeah.
Like, what about during the daytime? Like, what if I have to record a podcast and like the baby's screaming and no one's like taking care of it?
Your damn baby is screaming and I'm trying to record my important 911 podcast.
Now, don't say that. Addison Kane is going to get this podcast down. Oh my God. Dream guest alert. Dream guest Addison Kane, come
Addison
on the pod.
We are not getting... Well, I wouldn't object to like a gay Omegaverse fanfic writer, but I draw the line at a heterosexual Omegaverse writer. I love
Addison,
probably 70%
of
the people listening don't know what we're talking about, and I like the idea of hearing this out of context. Anyway, we go back to the Wilson household.
No, you will support Veronica, her messy ass, but you won't let Addison Kane come on the pod. What the hell?
There's any issue in logic there. So back at the Wilson household, Athena is over for dinner with Tony and with the gals, and Tony's, you know, telling funny stories about working at the casino. Mm-hmm. Everybody's having a good time.
Apparently,
she loved her job.
Apparently, she was the best blackjack dealer on the strip. So you know, clock that tea, like just stand in your power, Grammy. Now she also apparently she also cooked. And just judging by the scraps, I mean, it seems like she did a great job. Athena says that the ribs were melting off the bones. Like, I want to have some of that. Yeah. Now, it turns out Bobby couldn't come because he's spying on my... So Karen and Grammy go into the kitchen, and Athena's like, "I'm sorry, we couldn't get Bobby here." And he's spying on Michael Grant, who is taken to a sort of PI sort of role in this with his little telescope. Bobby is sitting on Michael's couch with Harry, and Harry shuffles off to do something, play a video game or whatever.
Michael makes him go do his homework. Right.
Stupid dads. Dads stink. P.U.
But Michael is like, you know, you should thank Athena for telling you to come over. And Bobby's like, well, she did suggest that I come over and thought maybe you could use someone to talk to.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Michael comes clean about his little pastime, his new hobby, because turns out this mystery man is having people from all walks of life, women, you know, half his age coming in, you know, yada yada, even some men. He's a bisexual mystery man with blood on his hands, and he's dealing in bruises. They always leave with bruises, and money changes hands. Okay, so Bobby, of course, is getting invested. He's like, oh, I have to know more. But before we can learn more...
Yeah, it's funny. Athena sent Bobby over as a mole, right? But unfortunately for her, he immediately just falls under the spell of Michael's new hobby. This is such a, like... dudes rock story
minor miscalculation, Athena, you know.
Right, like you think, unfortunately none of them have the sense. As soon as Michael brings Bobby into it, he's just like, oh yeah, this is cool, you're onto something.
Oh, I love them. Now here's the thing. Hen and Athena are on the couch. Athena is none the wiser to Bobby's, you know, falling into the dark side, because they're talking about, you know, Grammy being around, Tony, you know, being around all of a sudden. And Hen admits that she kind of likes having her around. It's taking a load off because she's distracting the kiddos, taking care of them, yada, yada, yada. And Hen's like, I could kind of get used to this, I'm not going to lie. And the second she starts to enjoy herself and having her mom in her home, she goes to check on her and Karen, who are making coffee or whatever. And she creeps up to the kitchen, not into the kitchen, because Karen and Tony are having an interesting conversation about Hen's decision to go to medical school.
And Tony is like, don't you worry that this whole thing might be a mistake. You know, you've got this stable life going. And Karen's like, why would it be a mistake? And Hen's mom says, isn't Henrietta a little too old? Which it kind of reminds me of that comment Margaret Buckley made to Maddie about, like, well, since you are having such a, you know, old lady pregnancy, she didn't say it like that, but, you know, she like kind of took a dig at her for being old too. I just find it funny, like the ways that the parents will like nag their children about being old is funny. But
such,
yes,
consistency.
Hen overhears this. Yeah. Hen overhears this and is hurt by it because, you know, just when she was starting to feel good about having her mom back in her life, she feels like her mom is kind of putting her down again, or trying
to
bulldoze again her ambitions.
We get this sort of sad, sort of like devastated look on Hen's face. Then we go right back to Bobby, who is now fully conscripted into Michael's plot. David comes home.
Bobby is standing there next to the telescope with binoculars. They've got the lights off. David comes home and tries to turn on the light, and they're like, turn it off, because they're spying.
They're spying. And, you know, this guy, he's just generating this trash, just generating it. So they come up with this genius idea. This mm-hmm. brilliant,
now the guy is like
plan.
Arguing with a woman. He's mm-hmm. in like a heated argument with a woman in his apartment. So they're like, something's going on for sure. Yeah. And they realize David makes this comment. David clearly seems like exasperated with the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the two of them, Michael and Bobby, are like, how are we going to figure out what's in his trash? And David, as kind of a joke, is like, well, you could always go through the dumpsters. And they both look at him like, yeah, we could.
Okay, so here's the thing, so both of them have a presumably base of legal knowledge, if not just because they're you know, they at one point or another were married to you know,
at one point or another
Officer Krupke over here. They were married, Bobby and Michael.
Michael moment.
They must have some sort of base of legal knowledge. So can I just say to our listeners, do not do this. Do not go through someone else's trash, because this is a very fine line to walk. Now, if trash is placed on a like the curb of like a street or something, that or like in a publicly available, you know, dumpster, then that is considered abandoned property and it's up for grabs. It's still gross, but you know, you can, you know, eat your heart out. If it is on private property in a private garbage can or a private dumpster or behind a locked gate of some kind, going through their garbage is a felony. It is a felony.
Man, I'll go through any dumpster I want. I won't let the big government tell me not to dumpster dive in my neighbor's
backyard.
This
sign can't stop me because I can't read, right?
can't read.
I'm just saying, guys, it's a dangerous game. I wouldn't play it if I were you. There are lots
Don't
of things you can find
me,
in the trash.
Sir.
And one of those things can be, you know, 5 to 7 years in the slammer with possibility of parole after 2.
I am entitled to my neighbor's garbage cans as an American. Anyway,
a hefty fine awaits you at the bottom of that bin. Okay, so here's the thing.
Bobby decides that he and David should go
They rope David in.
They rope David in, who wants nothing to do with this, but, you know, I guess he's whipped and he decides to do it anyway. And they're like, Michael, you stay in the apartment and keep an eye on the apartment next door so that you can like give us a heads up if coming down or anything.
Jane, what needle drop of a film score should we get in this moment?
Right. But they start playing that fucking Quincy Jones song. What is this famous for being in?
It's famous for being in fucking Austin Powers.
Oh, right. That's right. It's the bossa nova,
fucking,
the Quincy
it's
Jones
the bossa,
bossa
nova.
Nova.
It's the Quincy Jones bossa nova from the Austin Powers.
We all know it. Yeah, I was trying to remember what it was from, and I couldn't quite. I've never actually seen Austin Powers, but I am,
oh, you haven't?
Now that you mentioned it, I am aware
oh, you
of that connection.
Oh, I love Austin Powers. Those are my favorite movies when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I loved
but
those
movies.
But they
get down there. There's also, in the midst of this, they start rooting around in the dumpster, and they play this like cartoon cat yowling sound. Effect that I thought was so funny.
it's a junkyard cat. That cat is indestructible.
Yeah, just that thing of like, you know, they're rooting around the dumpster and then
and can I just say Bobby uh-huh. claims this is a gray area when he's actually in the dumpster diving and shit, but no, this isn't a gray area. It's behind a gate you know, is locked or unlocked, you know, whatever, but it's behind a gate and it is private property. They are committing a felony by doing this.
Give me garbage liberty or give me death, sir.
David gets misgivings because of course, and Bobby's like, you know, it's a gray area, you know, whatever. You know, Michael did help Bobby plan a bank heist that one time, so you know, I guess
right.
they're already
to which
in too
David's
deep
like,
now.
Wait, what?
but no, oh no, the bisexual serial killer is on the loose because he is coming downstairs
with
a
bisexual.
Bag of garbage. wow, the juice is loose.
Yes, so Michael tries to call Bobby, but Bobby's not picking up. He dropped his phone in the dumpster. Bobby is like the Grace Kelly to Michael's Jimmy Stewart.
I can't.
Luckily, luckily, they managed to get in contact with Michael in time, and they run away from the dumpster, but Mr. Bisexual sees them running away right at the last minute, so he gets that someone's onto him. Michael, once Bobby and David get back to the apartment,
they find in the trash bag, by the way, vanished. They find in the trash bag used surgical supplies, right? And they call Michael and they tell him
that's the
important.
Thing.
It's bloody used surgical supplies. Yeah, and so they get back to the apartment.
And Michael's not there, and they're like,
this is
Michael
so...
has decided to go investigate the guy's apartment by himself. Bad idea.
He's so stupid.
Right?
I mean, this is like, this crosses the line to actual felony trespassing.
Well, yeah, for starters.
To be fair,
Bobby says he's breaking and entering when they see him open the door to the guy's apartment. But technically, since he didn't have to break and enter, I think it's just trespassing.
Yeah, it's just trespassing. It's just entering.
The door was unlocked, okay?
Yeah, and if the gate's unlocked, it's fine. We established this. So he starts snooping around this guy's apartment. Ridiculous for him to do. This is the Michael storyline we get. this is the Michael episode.
No, I love it though. This is like the only good Michael storyline.
I do too. He finds what looks to be some kind of, you know, illegal surgical suite. There's supplies near the sink with like blood in
the
sink.
Like disgusting bloody sponges in the sink.
He suspects many things.
He walks into a closed room.
Mm-hmm.
He walks into a closed room. And he, like, hears some noises coming from this room. He walks in. There's this lady on an operating table in kind of a medical gown with these big patches of blood on the gown. And she appears to be unconscious or maybe even dead. But she wakes up. Michael's, like, scared out of his skin. She's like, help me, please. He starts to call 911 when, just like he's in a Lifetime movie, this bisexual guy sneaks up behind him and hits him in the back of the head and knocks him out.
That's right, guys. It's
Looks
the Michael
like
organ harvesting
the
episode.
The wrong apartment.
The wrong apartment. It's the Michael organ harvesting episode. Please clap. He wakes up. He wakes up, and David is looming over him. Oh my God! David was in on it. He's a surgeon. Oh no! No. The police are there. Athena
the
Grant
surgeon,
is on the
takes
scene.
Takes off one of those Mission Impossible face masks, and it's David underneath.
He was doing a White Chicks the whole time. No, Athena Grant is on the scene, and she is pissed. She's really not having it.
Michael did just commit several crimes in a row.
Yeah, and Michael, okay, first of all, can I just say, Michael, he immediately starts to describe the scene, and it's like, oh, there's no girl, oh, there's no blood, oh, there's no surgical supplies, so, you know, he got her out or whatever, or, and this is where I thought it was going, or
Michael
what
has
if,
another brain tumor.
I was thinking the brain tumor. I thought
oh
the
God.
Remission was over. I thought it was going to be a whole thing where it's terminal. It's not. Although that would have been, you know,
that's how we get Michael out after season 5.
That's how we do it. It turns out that it's actually just a evacuated crime scene that the guy cleaned up. I guess he was unconscious for long enough. Now, back in Michael's apartment, he mentioned, like, David's, like, doing, like, little, like, I don't know, a little checkup on him. He's a doctor. And,
giving him an ice pack. I learned from the IMDb goofs for this episode that in this scene, David is telling him the old concussion advice of, like, no, don't go to sleep. I think you might have a concussion. Somebody on IMDb in the goofs section says that the advice now is, that's not the advice anymore. Actually, sleep can help your brain heal. And if David was a real doctor, he would know that.
Well, unfortunately, he's not being written by real doctors.
He's being written by people who only know the out-of-date folk wisdom.
Exactly. Michael says something interesting here, where he says, I just had to go and fall in love with the brain surgeon. They're in love now. How nice is that?
They're in love. He's a brain surgeon. So much that we haven't seen. But I guess there was a time skip between seasons. They are living together, so it's stands to reason that they are in love.
Out of necessity.
But yeah, it does. There is something that feels a little out of place about that line, isn't there? Because what we've seen from Michael and David has not been reading as in love. Right,
no.
They seem like two dudes who live together.
Yeah, it's very bro-y. It's very like, oh, we share an apartment.
It's very chaste.
We haven't even seen them kiss yet. We haven't even seen them kiss.
Nor will we ever.
Nor will we ever. Like, I'm placing my money right now. We're never gonna see Michael and David kiss. I have to assume
it's weird religious Rockman Dunbar's fault. Physical or emotional intimacy, which does make it feel kind of jarring when he mentions being in love with David.
We saw Michael draw a shower for David once and then not get in with him.
I could draw a shower for anyone.
Yeah, exactly. But there's this question of like, what was the weird bisexual doctor doing to this woman, right? Because it's like, oh, is he stealing her kidneys?
That's the more important question.
We'll put a pin in Michael and David because I'm sure it'll come up later before Rockman's, COVID departure.
Oh my god.
Fuck
oh
ass,
my god.
Whatever he is.
Oh my god. I'm so sorry. We'll get through this.
So, turns out Athena did some snooping. They didn't find.
Well, Michael deduces that based on the fact that this lady didn't have a purse on her when she entered the apartment, she must live in the apartment, which kind of a big assumption to make. Like, she could have just kept her phone and wallet like in her pockets or something that they
she wasn't
see,
wearing pockets
whatever.
She had a medical gown on. All she had was a little keychain.
I thought they meant that they had like whatever. I thought they were talking about like they had seen her enter or something. But yes, they deduce that she must live in the building and she must still be there. So all the cops, somehow this is enough to convince Athena to act. That's lucky.
That's crazy.
Because all the cops.
That is
like,
crazy. If I was Athena, I would have jumped to brain tumor. I would have jumped to like, let's get you a CAT scan.
You would have thought that he was having some kind of like, that he had a dream or a hallucination or something. But yeah, they get all the cops there. They knock on every door. It's very Baby in the Walls vibes.
Mm-hmm. And David is also on the scene. David was sprung into action by this. And they start knocking on all the doors, of course. And then there's one that won't answer. So they break it down. I guess they have probable cause. And they got her. They got her. They got her. She is not doing well.
We got her.
She's not doing well. She's on death's door. It's a whole thing. She is exactly as described, which means that the brain tumor is not coming back. Now, while all this is going down, Hen is stacking mugs, but she's doing it angrily.
She is about to break those mugs. Ugh, I was cleaning out a mug earlier. I was washing it in the sink, and my hands just slipped and I chipped the mug. And I was thinking in this scene, like, girl, you're going to chip those mugs.
Because
she is just smashing them into the cupboard.
And Karen notices.
Karen comes up and is like, whatever you're mad about, I don't think it's the mug's fault. Like, don't take it out on the mugs.
So Hen, she's obviously mad about mom. And she, a lot of old feelings are coming up. You know, how mom questions everything she does. She doesn't have faith in her. She's like, oh, aren't you, whatever. Shouldn't you get married? Aren't you, too old to, start medical school? Karen's like, oh, you heard that. It's like, of course you heard it. The door was open. And Hen is getting justifiably defensive about it, but Karen is sort of as the woman who was having the conversation with Tony. She sort of gives voice to maybe Tony's side of things, which is that she's just, she doesn't realize that she's overstepping. She's just concerned about, her well-being, etc. And it's just like it's bringing up a lot of very, old feelings for him, about their relationship, because presumably this whole thing has been going on her entire life. Presumably Tony's always been this kind of, overstepping, proceed with caution style parent that sort of undermines a lot of Hen's decision making. And she says Aisha Hines acts her ass off with this line. She says, it's just another scar. Aisha Hines, the actress that you are. it's this very strange back and forth, because then we go right back to the Michael Peeping Tom storyline, and Athena's doing a Perry Mason rundown. She's doing a Perry Mason rundown.
Yes.
Like a mini one.
Yes, they are. Yeah, they're like, they caught the neighbor in San Diego this morning. He used to be a doctor down in Miami, but then he lost his license because he did too much malpractice, so now he's been running this underground clinic. This was reminding me a lot of other Ryan Murphy show Nip Tuck, because I think they did like potentially more than one storyline like this, at least in the first couple seasons I've watched, where first I think there was like an old guy plastic surgeon on the show who had started running this kind of shady business, like, you know, plastic surgery business, where he was like doing pretty questionable work, and that was a thing. And then in season two, I think there was this character who had been like a rival of the two main guy characters, who then somehow got down on his luck and became like a, I think he like got addicted to drugs and like became, started also running this sort of underground cosmetic procedure place, and was like, you know, basically like butchering people. I remember he like messed up a girl's face by leaving a chemical peel on for too long in one episode. Oof. Very nasty.
And we get mentions of similar things.
By the way, don't go get a chemical peel or lip filler or Botox from some unlicensed, unregulated place, okay?
Yeah, people die. People do die from that.
People die, or your face will get injected full of cement, or you'll get a bunch of, you know, acid on your face, and nobody wants that.
Yeah, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. I'm glad that you brought that up, though, because it was, yeah. I've been waiting for a segue to talk about this. I have not yet seen the new Ryan Murphy, Kim Kardashian star vehicle. I have not yet seen it, but I make a solemn pledge to you, Jane, and to all of our listeners now, that by the time we record our next episode, I will have caught up on it, and I will report back with news. So sit
well,
tight
listen,
for news.
I watched the first couple episodes last night, and I have to be honest, it's incredibly watchable.
Is it good?
No, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's not as bad as people are making it out. It's so here, it comes to us from the same creative team that brought us Dr. Odyssey. It's the exact same trio.
Oh, God.
Shocker, right? Oh, God. It's kind of vindicating to me that people are finally now recognizing that they're bad at TV writing. Mm-hmm. But I'm actually finding it a lot more entertaining than Dr. Odyssey. I think the premise is more watchable. And it's not, it still has some of the same pitfalls. Like, I've noticed they do a lot of the Dr. Odyssey thing where randomly a scene will just like exposit a lot of information in a really clunky way through dialogue instead of like showing you something. Like, there have been a few scenes where, you know, characters will sit down together and they're like, wow, it's so great that I'm this person and this is my relationship to you and we did this thing 5 years ago together, like just getting a bunch of information out in a really stupid way. I'll say this, the show has an occasional effective dramatic scene, partly Ooh. Because they've cast so many capable actresses. Like, there was one dramatic scene I liked between Judith Light, plays a character early on the show, between her and the husband she wants to divorce, but then they kind of ruin it at the end by like doing a joke. And then there's a scene between Glenn Close and her husband on the show that I thought was actually like an effective dramatic scene. So when the show takes itself seriously, and when Kim Kardashian isn't on screen, it's not that bad. But when it's being comedic, the jokes aren't very funny, which same with Dr. Odyssey. And the Kim Kardashian character is very uncompelling because she's played by the non-actor who is Kim Kardashian and who, of course, kind of makes us mad anyway because she's Kim Kardashian and we have a lot of reasons to not love Kim Kardashian. But
okay,
I would say the characters okay. are a lot more okay. interesting than the characters okay, on Jane. Dr. Odyssey, and the premise is more watchable.
Okay, Jane, you do not speak for me. That is all I will say on
well,
the
I
subject
speak for
of
me,
Kim Kardashian.
Which is all I ever claim to speak for. And, you know, I've only watched the first couple episodes, but honestly, I would keep watching it. I was enjoying it.
I'm really looking forward to watching
might,
it. It's going to be so fun.
I might make a video if I have it in me, because I would be interested to talk about maybe these two shows in conjunction with each other.
I just have to know. Dr. Odyssey. I just have to know what dirt he has on Glenn Close that he got
oh,
her
yeah.
to agree
oh, yeah. how did
to do
they,
this show.
How did they convince all of these people to be in this show? And
Eight
how did they
time
even get
Academy
another show greenlit
Award
after
nominee.
The disaster that was Dr. Odyssey?
Because he's Ryan Murphy and he has all the money in Hollywood because he's the most powerful man in Hollywood in TV now.
I guess.
The Glee checks are still clearing, you know? The Glee checks are still clearing. AHS got renewed with an all-star cast. Like, this is...
That's true.
He's getting a new renaissance is what's happening.
Yeah, it does kind of feel like we're having a Murphy renaissance. Should we get back to the episode?
We should. But basically what happened is after he started doing... the bisexual serial doctor guy, after he started doing his Botox, his fillers, and his chemical peels, uh-huh. he started escalating his services. He got sloppy, and he got. And that's what happened. And mm-hmm. Because of all this whole wrap up, because we're wrapping up the episode, now we also have to wrap up that Michael is no longer being a PI because he got employed. He got a contract.
Our man has a job. Yay.
He's doing some renovations on a grandma's apartment, which is nice. It's a check and it's something to do. And honestly,
no,
can
I think
we ask for anything more than
that? Someone wants
to
convert their garage into a grandmother suite, which is what you call it when you have like sort of an extra guest room.
Is that what it's called?
Suite in your house.
I've never heard it called that.
I feel like I've heard it referred to as a mother-in-law suite. But it might have multiple terms. It might be region specific.
So in Washington, we call it either a guest room or if it has a TV with video games in it, a bonus room. And usually instead of a bed, it'll have a futon.
Well, no, we have guest rooms too, but it's like the thing that makes it a mother-in-law or a grandma suite is that it's like almost like its own little apartment. Like it's got a bathroom, maybe it's got a kitchenette.
Okay, it's a different world out there. Okay.
Well, whatever. But
Karen
yes,
comes
he's
home.
He's got a job. The point is that he's got a job.
And Karen comes home. And Karen comes home.
Yes.
Hen misses a call from Karen, and she comes through the door with Denny mm-hmm. and Nia. And they reveal that they went to the park. They just got back from the park, and they found Grammy there, and she was sleeping. Oop. She was sleeping in the park in her car. Hen goes down, knocks on the door of the car. Turns out Grammy didn't get an Airbnb. Oh, she doesn't have any money. She's been sleeping in her car. She is homeless because she lost her job over COVID and got evicted.
Ugh. Yeah, this is a very interesting place for the story to go, I think. And
yeah.
I love this scene, and it made me love this whole relationship between Hen and her mom, because I just think
me
this
too.
Is great. Okay,
me too.
So it's revealed that, yes, Hen's mom has actually lost her job. She's been evicted, and she was kind of too proud to tell Hen and Karen what happened, and so she's been lying that she found an Airbnb. Presumably she was going to try and find a place, but mm-hmm. she felt a little too embarrassed to ask for help.
I mean, she's 64 and dead broke. You know, she doesn't have a dollar to her name.
Yeah. And she feels like she's failed and at this point in her life. And I just think this is some great communication between Hen and her mom. I really appreciate how it's not that Tony is like the most mature or the most amazing at communication, but she's able to own up to why she wasn't being forthcoming before or why she was seeming judgmental. And, you know, Hen's like, you've always judged me so much for all of my decisions. And, you know, why did you say that you thought I was too old for med school? And she actually admits it's not that she was judging her or that she actually thought she was too old. It's that she's always recognized that Hen has had this incredible ambition and this real mm-hmm. drive to accomplish mm-hmm. things, which Tony has never felt like she has, and in fact has felt kind of jealous of her own daughter at times, but very proud of her.
It's a very interesting thing that you don't really see discussed, like the idea of like a parent envying their child for something other than their youth, you know? It's like,
but mostly it's this idea that Tony feels like she's never been a super ambitious person, and now she feels like she's kind of squandered her life away and doesn't have any prospects at her age, and she feels like Hen has accomplished this really stable, incredible life, and she doesn't want her to kind of take any big risks that could jeopardize that, like having such a big career change at this point in her life.
And there's a generational aspect to this. You know, Tony brings up the fact that, you know, she gets this attitude like that she's had of like, you know, living for today because tomorrow's not promised. She gets that from her mom, and she got it from her mom.
In other words,
exactly.
I'm always saying this.
Yeah, we're always saying this. And, you know, she's never, you know, as jealous as she has been of her drive to succeed and the success that she's found in this life that she's built for herself, she's never stopped being proud of her. She's always been proud of her daughter for the things she's been able to accomplish, and that was a really sweet moment. And
it's just like nice and nuanced, and I feel like her being jealous is not the focus of the conversation. Like, that would be alarming if that was like a real like, it doesn't sound like she's been like actually actively resenting Hen all her life.
It's more of an explanation
kind of
for
that she wasn't mm-hmm. that she wasn't exactly. able to do that. And she finally, they get to the heart of it where Hen's like, what, you don't want me to end up like you?
Mm-hmm.
And Tony admits like, yeah, she feels like she hasn't always been very practical. And she's kind of, again, feels like she's failed. And,
yeah. Yeah. And it's a very sweet moment of communication. And it's like it feels like the first time in like a long time that they've been able to actually, you know, talk about something like with this level of like sort of depth and honesty and mm-hmm. get to the heart of this issue that's plagued their relationship. And it's really sweet. And they have this come to Jesus moment. And Hen tells this story about one time when she was 9, she told her mom that she didn't want to go to school that day. And Tony told her, you know, you don't have to go to school, but you have to learn something every day. So instead of forcing her to go to school, she took her to the library and then to a picnic in the park. And Hen read like 3 different books that day while she missed school. And it's sort of this moment of like, even though, you know, maybe Tony's not as organized or successful as Hen is, she still imparted many lessons that informed Hen's the person that she became, you know. And so Tony shouldn't mm-hmm. beat herself up too hard about the decisions that she made in her past, because ultimately she did still do pretty right by her daughter. In that regard.
Because also Tony was like, oh, you might get some of this stuff from your father. And Hen's like, but he wasn't around. You were. And you were doing the job of 2 parents and you were always there for me. And it's very sweet. And the whole scene made me think, like, I think the relationship between Hen and her mom is a very underrated one on the show. You know, I think you have these showier relationships of like the Buckley parents and the Diaz parents and even Chimney's dad and his parental situation. And we don't talk as much about how Hen just has this like very quietly grounded, real relationship with her mom that is, you know, not perfect. And we see her have her own parental trauma in this episode, but then like they come around and they have this healthy communication. And I just think it's so sweet.
Well, that would require the fandom giving a shit about Hen. So...
period. Ouch. I think that it's too bad. And I mean, also, it's like, you know, people go for the soapy drama more mm-hmm. than the sort of subtle, subtle, healthy stuff.
I mean, that's why they love Eddie so much, you know.
I was very into this scene and culmination of this.
And we button it on a really sweet moment because, you know, as Hen, you know, finishes up her story, Tony mentioned something about like, and it was all because of, you know, this one jerk kid giving you grief. And Hen's like, I never mm-hmm. told you about that. How did you know about that? And Tony's like, I'm a mom. It's what I do. You know, it's like, oh, she noticed more than she let on. And they're finally able to talk about it. It's very sweet. I love them. I love them.
Yeah.
And then we get you voiceover narration.
This bullshit narration that nobody's paying attention to.
Nobody.
But, you know,
it's all about neighbors.
Neighbors are important because they do whatever. And we see little snippets of everybody. You know, the mom rock band is doing their thing.
Maybe they're a Christian rock band now. That's the compromise.
I mean, Maddie and Chimney. Maddie and Chimney are delivering their care packages. Michael and David are like doing whatever, you know, staying a healthy 5 feet apart from each other because they're not gay in their own apartment. Mm-hmm. The neighbors are figuring out their property line. The one guy's in a wheelchair now because, you know, his leg was shattered by a falling Humvee.
Mm-hmm.
And at the Wilson household, Tony comes home because she's going to be staying with them for a while.
Oh, she let her stay.
And the kids are so happy about it.
It's so sweet.
And it is nice because it does seem like Tony helps them not be too much of iPad kids. You know?
Oh, definitely. I think that I really love this development. Then we go to Buck. He's ready to make nice. He knocks on Veronica's door. She opens the door to her loft, and it's so obviously the same set as Buck's loft, but just styled differently.
Yep.
It's like, it's so egregious. Like, everything is in place, from like the placement of the stairs to the porch to the bathroom.
Well,
it's
in these bigger apartment buildings, you often do have like rooms with the exact same floor plan and stuff, but yeah, obviously they just use the same set.
Like, even the way that they angle the camera, like when he walks out and sees Veronica, it's like a different angle. versus this, it's Buck, like, it's the same one. Okay, yes, Buck has
come over to make peace. He's brought some chocolate cheesecake. It'd be funny if she continued to be rude. She seems like she's in a much better mood, by the way.
She's glowing. She's got a very interesting glow about her.
It would be funny if she was just like, wow, so you just assumed that because I ordered cheesecake that one time that I just love chocolate cheesecake and it's my favorite dessert. Like, I don't know. I'm obsessed with like her personality.
It would also be funny if he brought her the cheesecake and she also wanted to compromise with him. So she brought him a bag full of shit. This is what your story reminded me of. That doesn't happen,
but she says to him, you know, I'm so happy and I really feel like I have you to thank, weirdly. You know, it's not every day that a bad date introduces you to a great guy. And Buck's like, what? And the shower has been running this whole time. Who should walk out of the shower but Albert? He's got like a little like towel turban on. Like he just did his hair care routine.
Yeah.
And Veronica has started sleeping with Albert. What do you know?
And Buck has a moment of bisexual panic. You can see it in his face. It's beyond.
Well,
it's bisexual
rage. I think
it's
supposed to be like an exasperated face. But yes, we could definitely reinterpret it as bisexual panic. And I do think it's funny that like, if I were him, I would embrace this because I'd be like, great, Albert, you can finally get out of my house and go live with her instead.
Mm-hmm. Instead, he's just like,
so I don't get to fuck Albert anymore?
I'm saying, like, I love Buddy and I love Buck Ravi, but Buck Albert. Balbert moment. Like, Al Buck.
No, it's just like when we say Buck and Josh should have dated briefly. It's like, this could have just been like a little stepping stone on the way to Buddy.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah. We just
Balbert
need,
moment.
We need to slut him out.
Al Buck moment.
God.
Well, that's about all she wrote about season four, episode seven. Thanks again for tuning in. A very fun episode this week.
I agree.
Season four continues to deliver.
Yeah, no, I'm fond of this season. I quite enjoy it. So thank you for listening. And share all of your Al Buck takes and I don't know, potential, you know, wasted opportunity Michael Grant storylines in the comments. If you'd like to support us further, follow us on social media at First Verse Podcast, spelled how it sounds. And if you'd like to support us even further than that, give us all your money on Patreon.
Or just like Venmo it directly or whatever works for you.
Send us Cash App, Zelle. We have everything, you know.
No.
we'll even take PayPal.
We put up our November bonus episode topic poll, and immediately it became obviously clear that the topic that's going to win is us finally watching the 911 and 911 Lone Star crossover episode, which we've never actually watched.
Jesus.
So that'll be a big deal.
Justin,
come back on the pod. We need your wisdom now more than ever.
We need a spirit guide for this one. I have never seen an episode of Lone Star, and I can't believe I did say at one point, I think, that I would only watch Lone Star if people paid me to do it. And you are. So
that day has come.
So be on the lookout for that. In the meantime, Al Buck forever. You know, Veronica is skinny.
Bikel forever. And Veronica, if you're out there, hit me up.
You have to match her energy on the date is the thing. You have to neg her back and forth
and just build the sexual tension.
You need to outwoke her so hard. I would be like,
oh, so you would assume that I was trying to body shame you instead of taking into account my own insecurities first? I would just be saying some bullshit.
It's like the Yuri equivalent of like, you know, like two yaoi boys being like, I bet I'm stronger than you, like that sort of thing. And then you get that like that moment of silence as you're like 2 inches apart. It's a whole thing. Veronica, come on the pod.